Everyone hits a bump in the road. What do you do with it? Be inspired as we explore the ways people experience, navigate, and manage the ups and downs and twists and turns in this road trip called life. Welcome to another episode of Bump in the Road. The basic podcast is always free. We also have a premium subscription called Bump 2 that lets you listen in on extended behind-the-scenes conversations with our guests. Check it out at www.bumpintheroad.us. Sue Robbins is an author, a mother, and a healthcare advocate. Her passion has its roots in her own early foray into nursing, but it was the birth of her son, Aaron, with Down syndrome that made her advocacy necessary. As a result, she's become a passionate spokesperson for the patient experience. Please welcome Sue Robbins to Bump in the Road. So, Sue, welcome. You're very welcome here on Bump in the Road. If you would, give people a little bit of background on your book.
Sure. I have two books. My first book is called Bird's Eye View, Stories of a Life Lived in Healthcare. And that book is my personal book about my experiences being what I term as half a nurse. I was a failed nursing student in my younger years. And also about my various bumps in the road, like when I got divorced, I got remarried, we had a child together, and my son ended up being diagnosed with Down syndrome, which was another big bump for me and really changed my life for the better. And also I talk quite a bit about my cancer experience when I had breast cancer almost 5 years ago and the experience that I had in the hospital setting. So that's my first book. And I have another book coming out. It's called Ducks in a Row. And that's more of my workbook about my work in patient and family engagement in children's hospitals. And really, it's a book about how to infuse more gentleness and tenderness and humanity into healthcare settings.
That's a big order. infusing care into healthcare.
It is. I actually have a sticker that says healthcare is two words. So it's health and it's care. And what I try to do is not just talk about ideas about, you know, how to infuse more humanity into healthcare, but actually things that I've tried that have worked, things that I've tried that have failed, because a lot of that is about change management and how people who work in healthcare settings, particularly leaders, are not that interested in changing the status quo. And so I've got lots of ideas and ways to address these brick walls that get put up for staff who really want change. So it's not just a pie in the sky book, it's very practical as well.
Well, I thought Bird's Eye View was just an incredible book. I really enjoyed reading it. I think one of the most interesting pieces was your own reaction to your reactions about your son who had Down syndrome.
Yeah, that was, you know, somebody said, what was it like to write that book? And I have been journaling all along, so I certainly had the details written down. But I really had to go back and look at why I was in so much grief when my third child was born. His name is Aaron, and he's now 18 years old, and he was diagnosed with Down syndrome. And to me, really doing that self-reflection in the book showed me that a lot of that was about how I felt about people with disabilities and people with Down syndrome. Because if I truly felt accepting and that all people were celebrating, why was I mourning so much when my son was diagnosed, when he was, you know, only about 2 weeks old? And so that was a very humbling experience to think about. It had to do with me and how I felt some negativity towards having a child with a disability.
It's not just you. I think our society expects us to be Instagram perfect, and life is not. How do you live up to such unrealistic expectations in any part of our lives?
Yeah, it's the whole idea of the, I think when you're expecting a child, you dream forward. Like the minute you find out that you're pregnant, you're imagining them, you know, going to college and getting married and you know, having grandkids and all that kind of dream that you have the moment you find out you're pregnant. And so what I like to say is when you discover that the baby you expected was not the baby you got, that's where the readjustment needs to occur. And so you really need to accept that you ended up with a different child than you dreamed of. And of course, anybody who's a parent knows that your children shouldn't end up in the way that you had dreamed of them. They have their own past, but typically you don't find that out until maybe they're teenagers, right? And they start asserting their own independence and making their own paths. But when you get a diagnosis, when your child is born, immediately that path shifts. And I like to say it's like the whole trajectory of our lives changed when that physician gave us that diagnosis. And that's a lot to process, I think, for families. And we're often quite alone. And I think that's quite harmful too. You know, it takes us a while to get connected up with other families. And really that's where our healing and acceptance comes from.
I think the isolation is really tough because whether it is a child or whether it is a cancer diagnosis, we don't ask for the isolation.
There were a lot of similarities. I don't want to say that having Down syndrome is the same as having cancer because it's not, although they are both big, what I would call like recalibrations of your life, right? So when I had cancer, gosh, a lot of people tried to minimize that suffering, right? To say things to make you feel better. Oh, you're brave and strong. Oh, you only have early stage cancer. Oh, you didn't need chemo. You know, like, I think they do that to make themselves feel better. But to me, cancer was actually a really big deal. Like, it was me looking at my own mortality and realizing that I was going to die, which of course we all know, but there's something about a cancer diagnosis that makes that really real at the time. And the only people that really understood that, I think, were other people who went through the cancer experience around the same time. I was lucky enough to go to a cancer retreat, and I think that's really where I found my community was in that, because like certainly my husband didn't want to think about that, about me dying. And I didn't want to burden that with my children either. They were going through their own grief because their mother had cancer. So you're right. It is a very isolating experience. And same with when Aaron was born, you know, I tried to go to regular mom groups with him, and it was not somewhere that we belonged because he was really an other, and I'm can't see me because I'm on podcast, but I'm putting that in quotes. And that othering, I think, is something that I had also not ever experienced before as a privileged white person who never felt like I didn't belong. And certainly someone, Aaron, because of his disability, has been othered many times in his life, and me along with him. So that was an adjustment too, is finding my own community and place of belonging.
You know, when I look at disabilities, I think we all have disabilities. You know, we all have strengths and we all have weaknesses. And whatever our unseen disabilities may be, it could be an attitude, it could be a fear, it could be something programmed into us early on. We have to cope with those. And I think we're awfully harsh on ourselves and each other in not recognizing the fact that we're all incredibly imperfect. And we're all struggling to some degree.
Yeah, I think this perfection, like you talked about the Instagram, you know, and the idea that we all have to be perfect. I think that's going to be the death of us. Like I talk a lot about change in healthcare, and part of the resistance to change is that, you know, physicians in particular are taught that they have to be perfect and they cannot make mistakes. And in fact, they're not robots, right? None of us are perfect. We're all human. So the idea of disability being an imperfection, I think, it's interesting because I talked to Aaron about this now that he's 18, about Down syndrome, and he very much realizes he has Down syndrome. It's something we talked about, you know, from when he was a very young age, and we've done lots of advocacy and activism, so he's been involved with that as well. And so I asked Aaron, do you want to be called a person with Down syndrome? Like I was asking him kind of about language. And he said, Mom, I'm not a person with Down syndrome. I am Down syndrome, he said. That's what he said. So that Down syndrome is a very big part of his identity. And certainly it is, I don't think, I mean, it's like having green eyes, right? Like it's a part of his genetics. It's embedded in every cell in his body, that extra chromosome. And we're trying, now that he's older, we're trying to get beyond acceptance of him, but actually celebration. I think that's the part, the evolution that you go through as a parent. And, you know, people say, would you take it away from him? And I wouldn't. It, like he said, it is a part of who he is.
Wow. You know, I'm going to go back to talking about perfectionism, particularly in the medical establishment. I think that it leads to an imposter syndrome, if you will, where particularly physicians have to try to put forth this facade of being so perfect, whereas underneath they may really just be screaming, and there's nothing they can do about it. The system is so hierarchical, so judgmental. I think it's a system desperately in need of some care.
No, I agree. I was actually on a panel yesterday for a session. It's called Gathering of Kindness, about kindness in healthcare, particularly about staff well-being. And, you know, what I always say is that staff well-being and patient well-being is totally intertwined. Like, it's impossible to unwind them, because if staff morale is low, then that's going to affect patients. Like, that's just a fact. And, you know, as far as patient safety, patient experience, all that kind of thing. And you know, particularly now during the pandemic, I know there are a lot of people leaving healthcare because really, gosh, it's been on the edge for a long time, right? Like, it hasn't had a lot of capacity. They've been short-staffed. They're always struggling as far as workload is concerned. And then the pandemic made it even worse. And so I feel for them. And it's not just because I'm worried about my own patient experience when I go into the hospital, is that, you know, if you have a good healthcare professional in your life, you care about them too. So I care about what happens to them in a way. I hope that they care about what happens to me. And that's the one thing I worry about, you know, as far as there's so much efficiency that's built into the system, even here in Canada, even though we're publicly funded, that really, you know, what ends up happening is efficiency, like, it always trumps empathy every single time, because there's so much pressure on the professionals to push people through the system. And I think it causes them a lot of moral distress.
Moral and emotional distress. And they have no place to express it, except perhaps some anger.
Right. And that's one of the, yeah. Well, you do see that as a patient, right? Like, certainly, you know, I remember walking into the cancer hospital and the lady that's a receptionist there, I mean, I don't think she likes patients very much. I think she must be not very happy in her job, because every time you walked up to the desk, she would look up like you were a bother, right? Like, you were like interrupting something that she had been doing, as opposed to looking up and smiling and welcoming, which is something I certainly talk about in both of my books, how, you know, that patients are the reason for being for healthcare. And I think that we have drifted far away from that. But then I also consider, you know, what is her work like? Like, she's on a clerical position, who is the person above her and how are they treating her? But really, in the end, I think it's important to point out that patients are not there willingly, that we are there because something terrible has happened to us, and that, in fact, anyone who walks through the doors, especially of a cancer hospital, is suffering in some way. And really, what my second book in particular is a call for is really to not turn away from that suffering and create gentle environments for us in order for us to start healing. And, you know, I worry sometimes we're so far away from that. Like, it's hard to know. I don't know. It's like, a bit frustrated sometimes about whether change can actually happen.
What do you think it will take to change our healthcare systems?
Oh, that's a big question. I have actually given up on system change. I mean, Lord knows I have been on every committee, every council, you know, every group that has ever begun that is around patient engagement. And, you know, patients are all really, I beat my drum about healthcare change and having more gentle healthcare environments, like, forever. I've been doing that forever. I think probably since I was in nursing school, which was many, many years ago. And so what I have shifted to is not system change, but actually individual change. So my new book, Ducks in a Row, is a lot about what a person can do within their realm of influence in order to advance change, even just a little bit. So I kind of believe in this idea of, you know, you do one thing and then another thing and another thing, and eventually you get to that tipping point where it does end up changing the system. But I think it starts with us as people. So some of the things when I worked in a children's hospital that I used to talk to staff about were very simple things, and they used to kind of make fun of me about this a little bit, but I'd say, you know, when you're walking through the corridors of the hospital and you have your phone out and your head is down because you're busy, I know you're busy, you know, but then there's families walking past you, what I would suggest is to create a friendlier environment is that you put your phone away, and when you're in public spaces, keep your head up and smile and say hello to people. And in fact, even one step further, you know, especially if you're in a big hospital, there's often people lost in the hallways, is if you see somebody who's lost, it is everybody's responsibility. I don't care what position you have, how big your title is, how fancy your shoes are, any of that kind of thing, to help somebody who is lost in the hall. And so if we can start with that, with the smile and hello, and not end there, I think that's something that we can build on. So really what I believe in, I kind of talk about this serenity prayer a lot when I'm talking to health professionals and thinking about what is in your control and what is not in your control. So I can't control how the system's funded. I can't control other people's behaviors, but I can control when I'm standing in the coffee lineup and I know there's a patient behind me, asking them if you'd like to switch spots in line. And that's something that we did in our hospital quite a bit, right? Like just swapping spots in line so they're further ahead in the coffee lineup and it doesn't inconvenience anybody else. But just really what it says to patients and families when you make these small gestures is, you know, I see you, I know that you're suffering, I care about you. And not just keeping it in your head, actually doing something to demonstrate, you know, that you care about them and how powerful that can be for patients and families.
And one of the things you write in your book is about how the loss of dignity makes suffering worse. And I think that's so poignant.
Yeah, I had breast cancer. So, you know, you think about the personal parts of your body and how they, your breasts of all things, and how they are really exposed to the world once you go into the cancer hospital. And I know like the mammogram techs will say to you, oh, don't worry, you know, I've seen 1,000 breasts, no big deal to me. But it is a big deal to me. I think that's what they forget, you know, the fact that, you know, you know, might not be covered properly by a gown, and how I'm not used to exposing my breasts to people, even though you see breasts all day long, and how really taking the time to think about how would I feel if it was me as a patient. I mean, that's really where the nuggets of empathy come from. And I think that in our very fast-paced healthcare environments, those simple acts can get forgotten. One of the things I talk about a lot in my first book is warm blankets and how I think they're a metaphor for all those small kindnesses in healthcare, because I mean, I can remember every single warm blanket that's ever been brought to me. And I think just even those simple, easy acts that do not take very long can make a world of a difference to patients.
Yeah, I agree. And I think change does start with the individual and it can grow from there. Trying to attack the medical hierarchy, the training process, and everything else is just beyond the abilities of any one person.
Yeah, and it's just an exercise in frustration, I think. And I think as patients, we get sold the idea that if we become involved and we get our voice in there, that we can change the health system. And I think it's actually a lie. I don't think that's not fair, is to expect us patients to do all the advocating ourselves. It's very heavy lifting. And gosh, you know, I've probably given 100 talks over the years to, you know, medical students and physicians and nurses. And, you know, I don't know, did sharing my story make a difference? I have absolutely no idea. I don't think I changed the system in any way. But you know, I do get feedback every once in a while that one person heard what I had to say and, you know, changed their practice slightly because of it. And that did make a positive difference for, you know, patients behind me. So I guess that's why I haven't given up yet, is that I think there has to be some hope, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't keep talking about this, that, you know, really, I think it starts with having safe spaces to share our stories. I think that's really important.
Well, you know, in a way, medicine is going through a lot of change. You look at, particularly in nursing, the numbers that are leaving medicine are astonishing. And that is going to be a game changer in its own way. And the reasons for leaving may vary, but I think at least a piece of it is people seeking some humanity.
Yeah, and I think staff need to be cared for in order so they can care for patients. Like, that's just a fact, right? Some of it does have to do with staffing levels and workloads. And of course, that type of thing needs to be looked after. But it's also about how, you know, your teammate, your colleague treats you, right? And really creating these environments. I mean, they do, I talk quite a bit in my new book about reflective practice, which is a way for staff to get together and talk to each other when something hard has happened in their workplace. Like, I have this story in my first book about, you know, talking to a bunch of intensive care nurses, pediatric intensive care nurses, so that they care for the sickest children imaginable in the hospital. And, you know, sometimes those children die. And I remember asking the nurses, I said, so what do you do when a child that has been assigned to you dies when you're working a shift? And they just looked at me blankly and they said, well, we get another assignment and we have to go back to work. And I said, they don't give you time, right, to honor that child and your feelings around that child's death. And they said, no, that's not built into the system. If we're lucky, we have a friend who's working the same shift and we might talk to them in the staff room, but otherwise we just have to continue on. And that, you know, that story just about breaks my heart because it makes me realize that, you know, the executives are making decisions so that the staff are not being treated as human beings themselves. They're not robots and they're dealing with human lives and human suffering. And really they need some time in order to process hard events. And that's what reflective practice is all about. And, you know, one of my big wishes is that hospitals would institute some sort of practice so that they have time to sit and think about some of these hard feelings, because compartmentalizing them and just shoving them away is not healthy for anybody.
Well, not just stop and think, but stop and feel.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I like to talk about feelings. I think that's kind of my thing, is to talk about how that feels. And in fact, I just finished reading a book called The Compassionate Leadership, and it's about healthcare. And there's this myth that if you feel things for your patients, that you will burn out. And in fact, there is a lot of research that says it's actually the opposite, that those people who shut off their hearts and shove away their feelings, they're the ones that end up in burnout because they have not had a healthy outlet to let those things go. And certainly, you know, my therapy I started after I was in cancer, that's what we talk about, right? Like, you don't just avoid hard feelings. And in fact, this book talks about self-compassion, and part of being compassionate towards yourself is acknowledging that hard things happen and you have hard feelings and that you need to look at them in order to get through them.
Well, I think you have to face hard feelings, feel them, and integrate them into your psyche, if you will, moving forward, because until we face these things that are difficult, they will just haunt us.
That's the thing. They don't go away, no matter how many compartments you have in your heart to put them into. And so, yes, gosh, if you think about from the patient point of view, you know, my oncologist was the most formal and professional, I put that in quotes, like acted like she was not, in fact, human. She never showed me any emotions. She was very, I don't know. She never touched me. She didn't ask about me beyond my tumor in my breast. And I realized she has done that to wall off her heart. Like, there was no way that I could see into her. I didn't know if she had children herself. I didn't know anything about her. But in fact, I think that makes people angry and brittle. And the one thing as patients, I feel as a patient that I need is to see my doctor as a human being. Like, I don't want a healthcare hero. I want somebody who's human and in that is imperfect. And I really think that, you know, in medical school in particular, physicians are taught that they need to be professional, and that means not being human. And, you know, the suicide rate for physicians is going up and up. And I think that's causing a lot of harm.
I think the whole training process causes a lot of harm. And medical school is mild compared to what people go through in residency. I think it's just such a broken system. One of the things that I see in the system is for so many years, you take all these very smart people and you essentially just abuse them, tell them they're stupid, they don't know what they're doing, and they're trying to just survive this brutal training process. And when they're done, they turn around and abuse the people that come along after them.
That's the whole mantra, I think, is that I suffered, so you have to suffer too. Like how could that not be harmful to people? Like and people working 36-hour shifts and just the way people are treated is, it's like they're using residents in particular as very cheap labor, right? I mean, most residents do get paid, but not very much. And so they do a lot of heavy lifting in the hospital. And even worse, I mean, my daughter is a pediatric nurse, so she just recently, 2 years ago, graduated from nursing school. And nurses are also used as labor in the hospital, but they don't get paid as residents do, right? Like they have to pay their tuition and they work in the hospital as students. But, you know, just really as you said, the abuse of them starts very early. And I think part of being compassionate with yourself is having the ability to stand up and say, no, this isn't okay. And certainly that's something that you'd be swimming against the stream in healthcare, because you're expected to be obliged to the hospital. And if they ask you to work overtime and extra shifts, and that you must say yes, right? That's your obligation. And I think that is causing a lot of the burnout, particularly now during the pandemic.
Well, medicine's about compliance for everybody, for yes. staff, for patients, right. You must comply.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They like us to be well-behaved, right? As a patient, that's what we're expected to be. And those of us that aren't, they don't appreciate us very much, I got to tell you. They
those
try to get rid
aren't.
Of us.
Yes. those of us that aren't are the ones that survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is good to speak up for lots of reasons, I would have to say. But certainly if you try to lodge a complaint, go through the complaint process or anything like that, I have to say that, you know, that's what I mean about sharing stories. Like there's good stories and bad stories in healthcare. And I really wish that we had a safe space to share both, because I think that's where the learning comes from. But often if you have a negative story about something that happened, you get dismissed and minimized. And, you know, if you're a mother, you get called hysterical. And, you know, like they really don't want to hear about that. And I wish that they were more open to learning from our experiences. And I guess that's why one of the reasons I wrote my books is that, you know, I didn't feel that listened to, especially with my cancer experience. So instead, I wrote it all down and published a book.
You know, one of the themes that goes through your book is uncertainty and having to find a new future in uncertainty with cancer, with a Down syndrome child. And it's so difficult. But the reality is we live in uncertainty, but we want to create this false world. You call it I love this. You call it a carefully curated illusion of life that doesn't really exist. And the only thing that really exists is reacting in the uncertainty and building from there.
Yeah, I think we can avoid it with certain things, uncertainty. So, you know, I think about, you know, as I said, those bumps I've had in my life, like dropping out of nursing school was my first big one. And then, you know, I ended up with an English degree. Well, what do you do with that in the early 90s in particular? I ended up staying in healthcare and working in healthcare, but not as a clinician, but in various positions with my degree in Shakespeare. But I had no idea where I knew what nursing wasn't right for me. I kind of felt like it chewed me up and spit me out again, which is why I didn't finish my degree, because I wasn't so-called tough enough, right, to do that. But what I was going to do with my Bachelor of Arts, I had absolutely no idea. But, you know, somehow it worked out, right? Like there's this great quote from the Magnolia Hotel movie, and it's like, everything's going to be okay in the end, but if it's not okay, it's not the end. So when you're in the middle of it, it isn't okay. But then after you're kind of over that hump, you can look back and go, oh, okay, that all made sense. But that uncertainty is, you know, very, very hard to live with. Same thing when your marriage breaks up, right? Like, because you don't know what's going to happen to you, what your future looks like. And gosh, we all wish that we had a crystal ball, but sadly we don't. Life catches up to you no matter what.
It does. And I think you find yourself looking back on some of these circumstances and asking, what is true? Because your sense of truth has been totally disabled.
Yeah, it's funny. I think we tell ourselves stories that we hang on to really, really tightly. And it's hard to undo that story and replace it with what is actually true. So I think that's a lot of what my work has been in therapy was, talking about stories that I learned when I was a child and how, gosh, I'm 53 years old right now. And why am I still telling myself stories that I learned when I was 6 years old? So, you know, that undoing of stories and looking at what's really true, I think is really hard emotional work. And certainly having big life events forces you to look at them. I have to say cancer in particular forced me to look at things that I did not want to look at and I avoided my entire life. But I remember thinking, gosh, if this cancer experience, I have to get something good out of it. Like I was really focused on that. And so I, you know, it couldn't all just be bad. Yeah, I had to have gone through it for some sort of reason. And so I realized my reason was so that I could better understand myself.
What do you think cancer does that?
It's something about looking at your own mortality. I mean, if you look at literature and poems and songs across the ages, right? Like that's something that we're most terrified of, is looking at the fact that we are going to die, not just might die. It's not just an idea or a concept. It kind of brings it to life. So I remember going through, I'm not sure if other people do this, but, you know, looking at all my pictures, you know, and reminiscing a lot about, you know, when my children were born and kind of going through that whole process of really reevaluating my whole life. And you know what I think cancer did is it told me I didn't have as much time as I thought I did. So if I was going to, say, write a book, you know, I was a writer before all this, a freelance writer, did lots of magazine and newspaper work. And if I was going to write that book, which, you know, all writers feel a bit of pressure to do, that I better hop to it because you never know what's going to happen.
That is so true. If you could look back in time at your younger self, what would you tell her?
Yeah, I have to think about that. That even that little girl, I'd say that, you know, you are valued, you are worthy, no matter what. I'd say, you know, that she is loved. I think about all those things that I had wished for, I think, when I was small, and I hope that I turned that around and gave that to my children, right? That piece of it that really, I think, with unconditional love, that people can do anything. And it's the lack of that, you know, the love that comes with conditions that really messes people up. So I think that would be the biggest part, that you are loved no matter what, even if you screw up, even if you're not perfect, even if you're not a so-called good girl, as I was raised to be, right? That we still love you. You are loved.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path, because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life. You can subscribe to our free podcast at www.bumpintheroad.us or become a premium member to hear the full conversation. Just go to www.bumpintheroad.us for more information and to sign up.